From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Some reporters work a beat their whole lives without any tangible result. But last week, Chicago writer and reporter John Conroy became one of the lucky ones when he was able to report on the conviction of a one-time Chicago police commander named John Burge. For 30 years, accusations swirled around Burge that he'd led a group of police officers in torturing dozens and dozens of mostly poor black suspects to extract confessions in a detective division known as Area 2 on Chicago's South Side. Despite internal investigations finding him guilty, despite being fired from the police force, despite then-Illinois Governor George Ryan being so alarmed at the implications of so many false confessions that he established a moratorium on the death penalty in Illinois in the year 2000, Burge had never been convicted of a crime. That is, until last week, when Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald secured a conviction for perjury and obstruction of justice. At that point, John Conroy had been reporting and reporting and reporting on Burge and his conduct for more than 20 years. It started in 1989 when Conroy was at the Chicago Reader working on a book about how ordinary people become involved in torture. He got a tip about a little-noticed lawsuit in his own backyard brought by a man convicted of shooting two police officers who accused Burge of torture.
Andrew Wilson alleged he'd been given an electric shock with two different devices and that he'd been suffocated with a plastic bag. He also said he'd been burned against a radiator, although I actually think the radiator burning was accidental. They pressed him up against a radiator and didn't realize they were leaving marks, because the goal, of course, is never to leave marks. And it was during the course of that trial that anonymous letters started arriving in the offices of Wilson's attorneys, and they came in police department envelopes, and they were clearly written by somebody who knew Area 2 and the detectives who worked in it, and he tipped those lawyers off to another victim who was then in Cook County Jail. Turned out that victim had been tortured back in 1982, 9 days before Wilson was, and he led them to a couple of other victims, and they in turn led them to others. The law firm that maintains the most accurate list has 110 victims. So the whole thing snowballed out of the Andrew Wilson case.
How many people were ultimately implicated in the Area 2 scandal, and what became of them?
There are dozens of detectives who have been implicated. Some of them have gone on to work for the Cook County State's Attorney's Office as investigators. Some work for the city as investigators. One of them started his own private detective agency. Some of them are retired. A few of them are dead. None of them have been charged with any crimes.
Turns out the word torture is a little squishy legally. Tell me why.
There is no such thing as a law against torture in the state of Illinois, or indeed in any other state that I'm aware of. If you were going to charge someone with giving electric shock, you'd have to charge them with aggravated assault or aggravated battery, official misconduct, perjury if the torturer lied about it. In the state of Illinois, there's a 3-year statute of limitations on charges of assault, aggravated assault, things like that. So unless you can indict within a 3-year period, or you can show an ongoing conspiracy to obstruct justice, which requires a renewing act every 3 years, all of those acts become untouchable.
So it's a war crime to torture somebody, but it's not a peace crime.
This is true.
So now let's talk about the journalistic issue. If there is no statute prohibiting torture, does that mean that you cannot use that word in describing the aggravated assaults that took place?
I think you can use the word. First of all, the Office of Professional Standards, the Chicago Police Department's division that investigates police use of excessive force, said torture was systematic at Area 2 and the command members knew about it. By anybody's definition, electric shock and suffocation, mock execution, burning against a radiator, all of these fall within the definition of torture. To refrain from describing it as torture is irresponsible.
Tell me the media history of this story. Tell me about the story you first broke and then what happened in the ensuing years.
I sat through these two civil suits because the first one ended in a mistrial. And at the end of that, I did a story for the Reader. That sparked an internal investigation by the police department. They cite that story as, quote, a sound starting point. And as a result, in 1993, Burge was fired from the police force. The press covered the firing as sort of a one-day story and never bothered to investigate what the implications of him having abused suspects were. You know, I continued to hammer at the issue from different angles because we couldn't keep saying the same thing. I went up the ladder. I wrote about prosecutors and their involvement in the case. I wrote about Mayor Daley and his involvement. I wrote about the father of one of the victims who was a police officer. And in about 98, the Tribune started to cover it. And Steve Mills and Maury Posley did a great job. They incorporated it into their death penalty series, which examined the use of the death penalty in Illinois from a lot of different angles. And their stories really led to the moratorium on the death penalty in Illinois. It's interesting to note that Posley was shown the door by the Tribune about 2 years ago, and they transferred Mills to the food safety beat.
You and the guys from the Tribune seem to be classic poster children for the chaos in the newspaper business, to the point that you found yourself blogging for WBEZ, I'm going to assume not for a great deal of money, just to see this case get to resolution. Are you that poster child?
I guess I am one of them. If you look at the Tribune, they had the best sources in the country on criminal justice, and both of those reporters are now off that beat or gone.
And you? Now what?
I'm hoping WBEZ will pick up the blog as some sort of permanent feature, but I don't know. In the meantime, I try to freelance. I write scripts for a guy who does health videos for the web. I wrote some copy for a bicycle parts manufacturer. I may do a story about torture for Rotary International's magazine. Meeting the mortgage every month, it causes me to break out in sweats sometimes.
In today's environment, would this story be covered? Will the next Area 2 be uncovered by the Chicago Reader or anybody else?
I would say there's a 50-50 chance that somebody will uncover it, and maybe it's even less than that. Certainly it won't be done by the Reader. They don't have any investigative reporters anymore, and it's not going to be uncovered by reporters like Mills and Posley who would go down and examine court files for 6 months. That's not going to happen. There is this belief out there among bloggers that citizen journalists are just as good. If you look at the coverage of the Burge trial, you can see the error in that thinking. I can think of one case in which a blogger did original research and wrote about a case on their own. So it's going to require some lawyers to do all the work themselves and hand it to a reporter, or it's going to require some reporter at their paper to argue that they should be allowed to take a lot of time and document exactly what's happened to suspects at whatever police station the allegations come from.
Well, John, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Chicago writer and reporter John Conroy is the author of Unspeakable Acts, Ordinary People, The Dynamics of Torture. He notes that although Burge faces up to 45 years behind bars, this story is far from over. There are at least 20 men who are still in prison based on contested confessions acquired by John Burge and his fellow officers.
If torture as an official designation does not constitute a crime in state legal codes, it does nationally. We've seen the issue aired over and over again in the age of terrorism, as in this 2007 exchange between Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Rhode Island Democrat, and Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey during his confirmation hearings.
Just to finish that thought, is waterboarding constitutional?
I don't know what's involved in the technique. If waterboarding is torture is not constitutional.
That's a massive hedge. I mean, it either is or it isn't. Do you have an opinion on whether waterboarding is constitutional?
if it amounts to torture, it is not constitutional.
I'm very disappointed in that answer. I think it is purely semantic.
Sorry.
We've had lots of discussions with media critics, newspaper editors, even NPR's ombudsman, over whether media outlets should apply the word torture to waterboarding, even if the term carries a heavy load of controversy or contention. Malcolm Nance, a former instructor at the U.S. Naval Survival Evasion Resistance and Escape School in San Diego, who prepared soldiers to withstand torture in part by waterboarding them, told us that no one should parse words when reporting on it.
Waterboarding is intended to put water down into your throat, into your trachea, and then with enough water into your lungs. You are drowning.
What phrase do you think the media ought to use?
Drowning torture.
Back in 2007, we called Los Angeles Times national editor Scott Kraft for a second opinion.
I think I'd be reluctant to call it drowning torture just because torture has become a politically charged word. It's actually at the very center of why we're even writing about it.
He was by no means alone in this view. We spoke to the Chicago Tribune and other papers. Our unscientific study suggested that his view was widely held, that journalistic impartiality demanded that serious news outlets steer clear of that semantic swamp. Recently, researchers at Harvard's Joan Shorenstein Center conducted a quantitative analysis of how waterboarding has been characterized at a few major American papers going back more than a century.
Over the entire lifespan of the newspapers, that's stretching back to as far as the 1850s for the New York Times, when the United States was the perpetrator, the practice was almost uniformly not called torture.
That was Neil Desai, one of the researchers on the study. We'll be hearing more from him in a moment.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As I mentioned, recently Harvard's Joan Shorenstein Center published a paper by students called Torture at Times, Waterboarding in the Media, in which they studied articles in USA Today, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Los Angeles Times, and found that for most of their history, they, quote, consistently classified waterboarding as torture. But after 9/11, things changed. The researchers also coded the stories for how waterboarding was characterized. Was it negative or soft, or was torture implied, and so on? The study has been both celebrated and derided. Harvard Law School student Neil Desai was one of its authors. Welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Could you summarize your lead findings?
I think there are two main findings of the paper. The first is that for about 70 years before 2004, the newspapers almost uniformly called waterboarding torture. After 2004, the newspapers virtually never called the practice torture. And the second main finding is that over the entire lifespan of the newspapers, that's stretching back to as far as the 1850s for the New York Times, when the United States was the perpetrator, the practice was almost uniformly not called torture.
Some of the only incidents after 2004 where waterboarding was unequivocally called torture on the news pages was when it was being carried out by other countries?
That's true. The Wall Street Journal had one piece that called waterboarding torture, and it dealt with East German history. One of the two articles that the New York Times referred to the word torture was about Chile, and again, had no mention of the United States.
Some of the categories you had for the treatment of torture in these articles seem pretty subjective. They're called negative treatment, softer treatment.
The big divide was, I think, between softer treatment and negative treatment. And those we broke down upon whether or not the term used had a necessarily negative connotation. So for negative treatment, something like brutal or inhuman, because no matter how you look at that, it is a negative term. Softer treatment terms were things like harsh or coercive or controversial. These, while they can be viewed negatively, don't necessarily have a negative connotation.
But you don't code a detailed description of the process of waterboarding as negative, even though it might come across as very negative to a reader.
That's true. Any simple description of the practice we termed just no treatment, because the narrative voice was not characterizing the practice.
How do you define a narrative voice?
We looked to see how the paper itself was coming through. What was the choices that were being made? How were the paper speaking, as it were?
Because many editors that we spoke to about the semantic treatment of waterboarding throughout the last couple of years have said that by describing it, the reader gets a very complete idea of how horrible this practice is, and that they don't have to use inflected adjectives. Most papers shy away from that kind of language when dealing with any subject.
And that very well could be what's happening. It's for others to decide whether or not the categorizations are right.
How did you deal with stories that use other people calling it torture? As in, for example, critics suspect the tapes contained evidence of waterboarding, which international human rights groups and others have denounced as torture.
That was a separate category that we had. And what we saw was that in a number of times that it was being used to balance softer treatment terminology. So an article would call the practice harsh, and then a few sentences later would say, or even in that sentence itself would say, it is a practice that human rights organizations call torture, or many call torture.
But you didn't count it as calling it torture.
No, because it was an editorial choice to include that, but it wasn't the voice of the paper itself.
Editorial pages all across the country were calling this torture. Couldn't your findings just be evidence that newspapers were moving everything that could be classified as opinion to the opinion pages?
It could be read that way. We did look at the opinion pages, and we found that in general, about 50% of opinion pieces call the practice torture.
Do you worry that your classifications may be presenting a picture of the American press as pusillanimous weenies who generally are afraid to use the term once it becomes politically freighted?
I think our classifications are fair. We didn't come into this study looking to prove a conclusion. We came interested in the question. Hopefully we've been very transparent about exactly the findings that we have, and then we'll let others draw conclusions based upon those findings.
It's fascinating that you chose to quantify this. Why did you?
We quantified it because if you have a specific basis to go upon, you can really focus in on the issues without the debate over what the facts are.
So now we know the facts that at least four large papers did not use the word torture when the U.S. was waterboarding, but did when other countries were waterboarding. That's the issue you wanted to get us closer to by doing this study, right?
Exactly. It's generated a lot of debate, and I think that's very positive.
What's the reaction that you've gotten?
We've only heard from the New York Times, and we have their response in writing. They characterized the study as misleading and tendentious and said that the decision to recharacterize the practice was done because it was a contentious issue, and they didn't want to prejudge.
Neil, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Neil Desai is one of the authors of the paper Torture at Times, Waterboarding in the Media.
Pakistan has experienced a media boom in recent years, moving from one state-owned TV station in 2002 to more than 90 private channels today. But an increase in news doesn't always result in a better informed public. The Washington Post recently reported that for the past 8 months, the U.S. Embassy in Pakistan has embarked on a different kind of hearts and minds campaign. It's actively trying to correct the record set by the inflammatory and, according to the embassy, outright false claims made in the Pakistani press. Larry Schwartz is the senior spokesman for the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad. Larry, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. Great to be here.
Pakistan was a breed apart for you, eh?
It's true. I've been doing this for about 27 years, and I've just never been in any place where I had to face such a consistent onslaught of direct falseness about the United States in the media. It makes it very hard for all parties concerned, including the public, to know who their friends are.
Now, when I read the story in the Post, my main reaction was like, duh. I've been reading for years and years and years about the rumor mill in the Arab press, you know, crazy conspiracy theories whenever anything happens in the world, the mischief often attributed to the United States. if you complained to your colleagues, you know, let's just say in Egypt, do you think they'd just roll their eyes and say, yeah, take a number?
I've served in the Middle East myself. I've served in Africa, in Asia, and other places. I'm not crying for mercy here. It was actually something that Ambassador Holbrooke and Undersecretary of State Judith McHale conceived when they came out here last August. They really wanted to see a very vigorous pushback. It's very important if we are to have the kind of relationship we'd like to have with Pakistan and we're to see Pakistan become the kind of country that it could be, that they have people telling them the truth about their relationship with the United States and America's intentions in the region.
Give me an example, please, of a story that was printed or aired that was just so outrageously false that you felt that you had to respond.
Allegations that the United States was involved in a conspiracy to murder Benazir Bhutto, that every American diplomat in the city is a secret paramilitary combatant attached to Blackwater. There are regular reports that our aircraft cross over into Pakistani airspace, which we have to deny. There are pictures of our homes sometimes put in newspapers as Blackwater agent homes.
What do you do to try to counter the false report?
We are now in dialogue with the major newspapers, the major editors, the leading television stations, and they know that they're going to hear from us when they really tell a whopper. They do this in Cairo. They do this in Paris. They do this everywhere, really, but nowhere do they have to do it as regularly as they do here in Pakistan. We've definitely felt a reduction in the sheer number and volume of outright vicious attacks by uninformed media. That doesn't mean that it's gone away entirely, but those who are well-intended are beginning to see a relationship that's important and different rather than one that they saw in almost transactional terms not long ago.
I have to ask you this. You were mentioning the lie that American aircraft are flying into Pakistani airspace. Now, it is the biggest open secret in the world that the CIA is sending Predator drones into Waziristan to fight Taliban and Al-Qaeda there. Are you suggesting that the U.S. is not a part of those drone attacks?
I'm saying nothing at all. I was talking about F-16 airplanes. Spokesmen around the world also do another thing when asked to talk about intelligence matters. We decline to do so, and I do too.
The U.S. does not have the best track record of telling the truth in Pakistan and elsewhere. It's one thing to respond to a lie with a fact, but do you find that your facts are dismissed with rolling eyes because they come from you?
I've been defending Americans' foreign policy straight, you know, since 1983. You can imagine the changes that I've been through and the things that I've had to speak. You know, American diplomats always explain and defend America's foreign policy abroad. But the good news about American diplomats is we're allowed to admit that there are Americans who see things differently.
You can imagine, you just said, the things you've had to say. Would you care to amplify?
I actually wouldn't, but I think that you know the many twists and turns of our foreign policy over the years.
What's your biggest success been?
The sheer volume of anti-American, non-fact-based attacks on the United States has dropped as our engagement has expanded. This is precisely what we would have hoped. Some might call it a freezing effect.
Chilling effect, yeah. Intimidation.
I'm not interested in intimidating anybody. And besides, I haven't got that authority here as a guest in this country. My job is to make the case for U.S. foreign policy, to support a closer relationship between the United States and Pakistan, and to build a future of our two countries together in favor of a region that finds peace and development rather than instability where extremists can continue to do their malevolent work.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks very much to you guys, too.
Larry Schwartz is the senior spokesman for the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan.
Time was, if you were doing your job as a journalist, and as the saying goes, afflicting the comfortable, then the comfortable would push back and sue you for libel. True, media outlets also simply made mistakes or printed false claims, but dealing with the legal hassle of libel suits was seen as an inevitable part of journalism. So imagine New York Observer reporter John Coblin's surprise when he followed a lead recently and found that in the last few years, libel suits have all but disappeared against the media. Coblin called Time Inc. to ask how many libel suits it currently had. He reached Robin Bierstadt, a 27-year veteran of Time Inc.'s legal team who'd fought back against libel suits by groups like the Church of Scientology. He reached her just in time. She was retiring later that week, and the reason, she explained, was simple.
No more lawsuits. They have not had a pending libel suit over the course of the last year. I then called up the New York Times Company, and the New York Times Company said they have not had an active domestic libel suit on their hands for a year, since last July. And that includes the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and lots of regional newspapers.
Now, is it possible that these kinds of suits may have migrated to small local papers where the impact of a defamatory article might be greater?
It's very possible. I mean, one of the theories that media lawyers have right now, if they're not happening to the big media companies, it could be your smaller newspapers. But there is no concrete evidence on this. Most of the lawyers who I spoke to have represented large media companies. And the thing that they said, it might be happening down there, but we don't know. But we know we're not seeing it up here.
So let's talk about some of their favorite theories. After years of suing companies like Time Inc. and the New York Times, plaintiffs have realized that these cases are losers?
That is a popular theory. The fact that in the U.S., if you sue, it's a libel claim. Generally, it's going to go in favor of the media company. And these are very long and onerous lawsuits. It's expensive. It doesn't work.
Theory number two is just the ubiquity of the web, which seems to balance out the power of any single media company. For instance, when the musician M.I.A. contested a recent profile of her in the New York Times Magazine, she didn't sue. She tweeted her objection. She posted raw audio from the interview along with the reporter's cell phone number. The internet seems to allow potential plaintiffs to fight it out instead in the court of public opinion.
This is the theory that I buy the most. The fact that there is so much out there on the web, the impact of a Time story isn't the way that it was even 10 years ago. And I think potential plaintiffs who would want to sue have to say, this isn't going to harm me in the way that it might have a few years ago. And the point that you brought up, they can put their own responses up. They could go to the Huffington Post and write a blog post. They could post something to their own blog. And if you're upset and you call up that company, there's a good chance that if you're going to get a correction, instead of it sitting in the magazine a week later or 2 weeks later or the newspaper a few days later, you can get it up on the web immediately. So when people Google your name and look at that story later on, they won't see that incriminating fact that you were so upset about.
And newspapers and magazines seem more responsive because they have this mechanism. They do it faster. They don't fight the corrections perhaps as hard.
If you have somebody who's angry and is putting their own response out there and putting their own spin on the story, there is no stonewalling anymore because they're going to have their voice heard. And suddenly, the focus of the story is not your story anymore. It's their response. George Freeman, who's a counsel at the New York Times Company, said, if somebody's upset and we were wrong, we will put up the correction immediately.
I think the scariest theory is the one that involves the suggestion that financially strapped news organizations, first of all, they're putting less money into the kind of investigative reporting that might engender these kinds of suits. And second, they've become so legally risk averse that they avoid investigating the most litigious organizations, like, say, the Church of Scientology or Disney.
Every media lawyer is a little squeamish to talk about this theory because they still represent big companies, and I don't want to admit that they don't perform the type of journalism that would have produced libel suits in the past. But nevertheless, we have to consider this. 15 years ago, when media companies were doing very, very, very well, you get an angry phone call, you're happy to pursue that lawsuit. Doesn't matter. We've got money. But now, in a time where everybody is strapped for cash, all of a sudden, if they make that angry phone call pre-publication, you start to seriously consider editing some stuff out because who wants to go down that road? Floyd Abrams made a point of this in the interview that I had with him, the very famous First Amendment lawyer, said this is something that media companies carefully consider now, much more so now than ever before.
Now, you've noted that there are fewer libel cases in the U.S., but even more libel cases in Europe, especially in places like the U.K., where the libel laws favor the plaintiffs far more than they do here. Have libel suits, do you think, just migrated to places where they're easier to win?
It is the one loophole. But every media lawyer I spoke to, none of them had a sense that this is a loophole that is exercised much.
When you step back from this trend, are you left with just another sad story of the slow demise of major news organizations? I mean, Time may not be getting sued anymore, but are people there lamenting that maybe, in large part, it's because Time has lost its mojo?
The media's influence is now not just held by a few big newspapers or magazines, and it's certainly an example of that diminishment of power. Whether or not it represents our slow demise of the media overall, I don't think this story at all suggests that.
John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
John Kovlin writes about print media for the New York Observer. His piece, The End of Libel, ran at the beginning of June.
Coming up, crowdsourcing to get cheap labor is great, as long as it's not your livelihood being crowdsourced.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from Anne and John Herman, supporting the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at breakthroughcollaborative.org. LendingTree, committed to helping people control their financial destiny with innovative tools and personalized advice at LendingTree.com. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When I wrote my most recent book about the chaos created by the digital revolution, I, of course, needed a cover. In the spirit of my subject matter, I crowdsourced the project through an online site called crowdspring.com. More than 100 designers from around the world took on the project, and the winner got $500 plus the glory of illustrating the chaos scenario. Everybody was happy. Everybody, that is, but the hundred-some freelance designers who labored on spec, working for nothing, and the established designers who never got to bid on the job at any price. In my book, I expressed qualms about participating in this corner of the digital economy. Was I putting people out of work and exploiting labor, or was I giving an opportunity to people who had been shut out of the market by an entrenched establishment? I chose to emphasize the positive and to pocket my savings. But now CrowdSpring is hitting close to my home, outsourcing writing projects under pretty much the same model. And suddenly the democracy of the internet doesn't seem all that attractive. Michael Sampson is the co-founder of CrowdSpring.com, and he joins me now. Hey, Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, first, tell me how it works. I have a design project. What do I do?
You write a creative brief which describes what you're looking for, what your needs are, what your requirements are. You name your price, you set the length of your project, and you click a button to pay for it and post it. In turn, creatives from around the world submit designs or writing samples to your specifications. At the end of the process, you pick the one you like best. That person gets the money, and the two of you walk away happy.
Now, digital tools have made your business something like an inevitability, just like the steam engine made mass production of, say, shoes an inevitability. But the Industrial Revolution also spelled very bad news for cobblers, the shoemakers who were basically priced out of the market.
When shoes could be mass-produced, all of a sudden many, many, many more people had access to high-quality footwear. And the quality of their life was improved. CrowdSpring and platforms like CrowdSpring provide the same function in a more modest way for the consumers, the buyers of creative services. That buyer who comes to CrowdSpring with a $500 book cover project or a $300 logo project couldn't afford the fee that a traditional designer charges. So their options before a platform like CrowdSpring were very limited. They could buy clip art out of a catalog, they could ask their talented niece or nephew to do it for free, or they could buy some software and try to do it themselves and typically do a pretty bad job of it. So to have access to great design at a price point that they can afford brings them into the market in a way that they couldn't come into the market before.
But there's a second question, Mike, and that's an ethical question concerning the new labor force. when they participate in CrowdSpring, when they bid on my book cover or somebody else's logo or a webpage design or what have you, 100 or more entries for each project come in, one winner. The winner gets paid poorly, according to the professional scale, and the others get paid not one red cent. Can you explain to me why this is an exploitation?
All of the work that was created for your project, except for that one winning entry, remain the property of the person who created it. They can resell that. They can use it as a template. They can use it in their marketing materials. We give them the opportunity to create. Now, we did a survey of creatives just a month or two ago, and one of the questions we asked them was, how long does it take you to create an entry to a project? Well, the answer was, it takes me about as long to create a submission for a project on CrowdSpring as it does to create a bid in the traditional process. Ask any designer, and I pretty much guarantee you that they would rather spend that 2 hours preparing a design than they would preparing a bid. They don't know if they'll get that job either.
Okay, schnooks like me have used CrowdSpring, and I guess a lot of mom and pops. But others who are not mom and pops have also used platforms like yours. I'm talking about Random House, Barilla Pasta, Epic Records, the metal band Judas Priest. Doesn't that kind of confirm the worst fears of the established design community?
Well, yes and no. Big companies do come in and post their project with us. Now, the reason they do so isn't just to get the artwork or the written content. They're trying to learn how they can leverage this platform and this process to engage audiences. Judas Priest, frankly, they've got plenty of designers who could have designed that tour poster for them. Epic Records has lots of designers on staff who do this every day. But what you can't do with an in-house design department is you can't engage the fan base in a way that makes them want to buy merchandise and want to be associated with the band. So when Epic Records posted that project for Judas Priest, they put the word out to the fan clubs and the fan sites, and the fans flocked in to participate.
You know, it's funny how a person's reactions can be different based on whose ox is being gored. What were vague ethical qualms I had when doing my book cover suddenly have me in a full-blown panic, because I can see very clearly that the amount of money that I can fetch for the kind of writing I do, just by virtue of the law of supply and demand, has to go down.
We truly believe we're not a threat to you. What an established professional or a creative shop or an ad agency does that we can't do is provide a certain kind of value that's one-to-one, that's hand-holding, that's strategic, that's brand-building. So a buyer who wants to come and just get a nice logo for the side of their truck or a shingle to hang out over their business can come to us and get that. But a big company with the more strategic imperative is going to still need to go the established route with the established professionals, the established agencies and design shops.
Them's pretty words, Mike Sampson. They have not, however, been all that soothing to the people in what is called the no-spec movement, a group of design schools and businesses and individuals who themselves refuse to produce work on spec and are trying to rally the rest of the crowd to follow the same ground rules. Are they a threat to you?
No, we don't think so. We have a community of about 64,000 designers and writers. About 50% of those are U.S.-based. The membership of the AIGA, which is the leading professional organization of graphic designers in the United States, has a membership that's a fraction of that size. And that's nothing against the AIGA as a professional organization, but what it says is there is a need and a hunger out there.
Their claim is that not only does a user of spec material prey on an exploited class of labor, it also generates inferior results. However, the Wright brothers were bicycle mechanics. Do you have to be a professional designer to create professional designs?
No, you don't, frankly. The Nike logo was produced by a student who reportedly received about $20 in payment. I understand she did get some Nike stock, which paid off over time. But I think that history is rife with examples like those of quote-unquote amateurs producing phenomenal work.
Well, Mike, I remain queasy, although I can't say why, but I do appreciate the time you spent with me. Thanks so much.
And thanks to you, Bob. I really appreciate your time, too.
Michael Sampson is the co-founder of Crowdspring.com.
On Tuesday, the Dalai Lama, the head of the Gelug sect of Tibetan Buddhism, turned 75. He was forced to flee Tibet in 1959 in the early years of China's occupation, and he's been a thorn in China's side ever since. There seems to be no end to the struggle, at least while the current Dalai Lama still lives. And on his birthday this week, he noted that he was in good health and could well live another 30 years. That means another 30 years of disastrous public relations for China. As we noted in the next report, first aired in 2007, the Dalai Lama has evolved as a media manager over the years. The affable spiritual leader always seems to extend an olive branch to China that he must know will always be rejected.
Although we prefer direct communication with Chinese government, Chinese leaders, we haven't found proper opportunity.
Born in a poor farming village in 1935, he was two when he was identified as the 14th incarnation of the Dalai Lama, Tibet's spiritual leader and head of state. In 1959, he was on the run, living in India. Robert Thurman, now a professor at Columbia University, studied with him there and became the first American ordained as a Tibetan monk.
To me, he was like a really nice young guy, a little nervous and very sweet and friendly. He didn't bowl me over with his sort of superstardom.
He launched his perpetual tour in 1967. He's since met with many thousands of ordinary people, presidents, prime ministers, patriarchs, and popes. He's been on Time's list of the world's 100 most influential people. He's won the Nobel Peace Prize. He's been savaged by Christopher Hitchens. It doesn't get better than that. What's his PR secret?
You know, people ask me often, like, who manages the Dalai Lama's PR and who's his PR firm and all this. And he's never had one. And in fact, sometimes they've been offered pro bono by different PR firms. And his people and himself have always declined because they don't want to be packaged without their own long-term understanding. They want to control their own image.
All he really wants is to get a simple message out about compassion and Tibet. But public relations isn't simple in such a complicated world.
He was on Larry King a bunch of times about 5-6 years ago, and he turned down some other programs. I won't mention names, not to embarrass them, but, you know, that have a 50 million audience instead of 1.2 million audience.
That program was Oprah's.
Tibetans, you know, they come from high altitude, you know, they climb mountains and things, and they herd yaks. And they're very self-reliant.
But, I mean, how self-reliant can you be in New York if you don't know the difference between Larry King and Oprah Winfrey?
I don't know. That's what we say sometimes.
Some of the Dalai Lama's public relations problems are far less innocuous. In 1998, he acknowledged that his administration in exile took money from the CIA in the 1960s, that the country he briefly ruled condoned what amounted to serfdom. He was accused of speaking out of both sides of his mouth on the issue of homosexuality. And he's friends with Richard Gere.
But somehow, there seems to be this bounce-back quality to the Dalai Lama, a sort of Teflon thing, that these things just seem to add to his glow somehow.
Robert Barnett is a lecturer in Tibetan studies at Columbia University.
And he doesn't seem to get pulled down by even the slightly more difficult figures like the Steven Seagal, that film star who got declared by one Tibetan Lama to be himself the reincarnation of a 17th century Tibetan Buddhist teacher.
You and I were the same.
There's a difference, my man. You have faith.
I don't.
For real?
For real, yeah. And this really seemed to be the limit of credibility. I mean, a huge number of Buddhists were shocked and horrified by that. And the Dalai Lama carefully distanced himself from that. He seems to have survived it.
There's an old and durable aphorism about media that they love to build those heroes up and then take them down. How come he hasn't been taken down.
I don't know. I have to admit that I'm one of the people who said, you know, 20 years ago, it wouldn't last, you know, and I'm wrong. So I shouldn't be making guesses here.
Maybe it's that particular element in Tibetan Buddhism that seems to bestow enlightenment at random, even on Steven Seagal?
So there is a great appeal to that, that you don't know where these great lamas are going to appear.
Donald Lopez is a professor of Buddhist and Tibetan studies at the University of Michigan.
It could be in Tibet, it could be in California. Anybody's child, at least hypothetically, could be the incarnation of a great lama.
I'm nothing special. I'm just like you.
But maybe we just love the way he combines modernity and tradition, the spiritual with the commercial. Literally, Robert Barnett.
He did a series of advertisements once, wasn't it, for Apple computers, which was big as well. You see, where he places himself in front of the modern and in front of the fashionable, all the things that he would appear not to be.
Or maybe we love that movie stars follow in his wake.
Buddhism always caught on first in the royal court.
After all, says Donald Lopez, celebrities are our royalty.
The aristocracy, the nobility, who find Buddhism somehow interesting. And so when people complain, as they often do, that Buddhism seems to be kind of a celebrity religion and all of the Richard Gere and Sharon Stone and so forth are devotees of the Dalai Lama and somehow take offense at that, I think they're missing a larger historical perspective.
And then there are the movies about him or his native land, Bernardo Bertolucci's Little Buddha with Keanu Reeves, 7 Years in Tibet with Brad Pitt, and especially Martin Scorsese's Kundun with actual relatives of the Dalai Lama.
Holiness, the Chinese have moved their camp. The Oracle's route is safe for us now. We must go.
Yes.
Sanctuary has been arranged in India. They're expecting you.
Kundun helped give Tibet an identity distinct from so many other oppressed minorities. Before the current crop of films, there was only 1937's Lost Horizon by Frank Capra, whose Tibet was Shangri-La, pretty much an Oriental Brigadoon.
Tibet always was the empty space on the map.
Robert Barnett.
Not just in Western accounts, even in the first millennium in Arabic accounts, Tibet was being described in this way as the empty space, that really was the space on which people could project fantasies. I think that he's taken that Tibet that's played that role in history and turned it into a sort of personal Tibet. He's now a walking empty space that travels around in which we can place some of those fantasies and actually go and listen to him. And he's humorous and immediate and very tangible. And it seems to be a sort of Tibet that's come alive, even though Tibet, the country, has disappeared.
Barnett believes it's empty space that forms the basis of the Dalai Lama's appeal, the reason why his constituency can range and change from Indian conservatives to American hippies.
What I mean is that the Dalai Lama, in his general talks, is presenting a kind of philosophy and a kind of approach to life that is really not marked by anything in particular. It's almost featureless, just an idea of compassion, treating people well.
Compassion is important because more compassionate mental attitude there, you can see everything more better, more clearly.
It's classically what media people talk about when they try to find neutral terminology, something that could be open to almost anyone who listens to it. My guess is that that's what's made this happen. And I should add one thing. He has received enormous help constantly from the Chinese authorities.
That's the capper. That's what makes Dalai Lama mania so enduring. Aside from his profoundly appealing message of peace and love, of course, you couldn't buy a better foe than the People's Republic of China.
They just constantly repeat the kind of propaganda dream of attacking him again and again. It's a bit like a Rottweiler savaging a puppy. They make him look more and more docile every time they bare their teeth.
I have nothing to offer, just to listen, to learn myself.
The Dalai Lama is 75. China's best chance for winning the PR war may just be waiting for him to pass away. But since we're talking about someone who's forever reborn, it could be a very long wait.
So, that's all. Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, who is leaving us temporarily to go have a baby. Good luck, Naz. We'll miss you. The producers had help from Brett Jaspers and Michael Chaplin, and the show was edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You could also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.